My guest today is Thomas C. Mountain. He's the most widely distributed independent journalist in Africa, hailing out of Eritrea. You can find his work on Counterpunch and RT and all over the internet, actually, if you just Google up Thomas C. Mountain. I'd like to talk today about some of the, in my opinion, very undercovered horror stories, and that is about the whole Horn of Africa. And Thomas, before we get into some of the specifics about Al-Shabaab and the famine and the drought and the refugee crisis, could you give us a sort of history, a quick history of the Horn of Africa, how it got into the situation, something that goes a little bit beyond a movie like Black Hawk Down?
Black Hawk Down, infamous Black Hawk Down movie, they supposedly covered that. But what they didn't tell you in Black Hawk Down was that what they were really up to, this all-white elite unit in the U.S. military, was they attacked a gathering of Somali elders from all across the country, the southern part of Somalia. They had almost 200 of the senior leaders of the Somali community gathered in Mogadishu to have a peace conference and to try to put the country back together. And the Americans attacked it and slaughtered them all. And this is what enraged the Somali and caused, you know, the attacks and what was portrayed in Black Hawk Down. What they didn't tell you was that the Americans didn't want Somalia to be reunited and peaceful. And ever since then, Americans, United States policy in Africa in particular has been crisis management. In other words, create a crisis, better to manage the chaos and conflict that goes on as a result of the crisis so that you can loot and plunder the country's resources. If it's not about looting and plundering the country's resources, particularly in Somalia, it's about a country that's in a very critically strategic part of the world. Now, when we speak of the Horn of Africa, in the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen a dramatic shift in world economic power. Whereas Asia and North America used to be the number one trading partners in the world, that shifted. Now Asia and Europe are the number one trading partners in the world. And all the trade that goes between Europe and Asia, particularly Japan, China, it all passes through the Horn of Africa. It's called the Baab al-Mandeb. The Gate of Tears, the entrance between the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa, is one of two strategically critical choke points, the other being the Suez Canal. We've seen what the United States is doing in Egypt, funding $1.5 billion a year for the Egyptian military, basically paying their salaries so they can do what the United States wants, which is, one, protect the Suez Canal, and two, not be a threat to Israel. Well, when we come to the Horn of Africa, we've got Somalia on one side, Yemen on the other, and then on the Red Sea side, we've got Eritrea, where I'm island. Now, you know, what would the situation be if Somalia was an independent, united country under an independent, nationalist, Islamic-led government? And they were to come along and say to the United States, hey, look, you can't support the rebels in Syria, or you cannot attack Libya, or we will shut the Horn of Africa down. We will block all the trade between Europe and Asia. And Somalia could do that if they had a strong, united, independent government. So the United States is not going to tolerate something like that. And they would rather see Somalis kill each other than to see something like that come to play. In 2006, after 15 years, the Union of Islamic Courts brought peace to Mogadishu, to southern Somalia, for the first time. And it reopened the port. The airplanes were landing again. It looked like Somalia was headed towards peace and stability, and maybe even their program was to unite all of Somalia again. Well, the United States is not going to tolerate that. They're not going to see an Islamic movement, nationalist, independent Islamic movement, come to power in Somalia. So they sent the Ethiopian army, their policemen on the beat, into Somalia. Now, U.S. foreign policy prefers to have, rather than do the dirty work themselves, the U.S. has policemen, local policemen, to do their dirty work, the gendarmes in the region. In South America, they've got Colombia. In West Africa, they've got Nigeria. In the Middle East, they've got Israel. And in the Horn of Africa, it's been mainly Ethiopia, even though Ethiopia now has been major cracks in the regime and serious problems. So, you know, but the United States historically has been using for the last 20 years Ethiopia as their policemen, their local enforcers, their thugs to do the dirty work in the United States, and they did that. They went into Somalia. Now, no Ethiopian government in the last 100 years has picked a fight with the Somalis. Everybody knows that. You know, don't go looking for trouble with Somalis, because it's just not worth it. And yet the Ethiopians went in and For 2 years, from 2006, 2008, Ethiopia invaded and occupied Somalia, and they unleashed a whole wave of Somali nationalism. Now, when the Ethiopians invaded, they basically drove the elders that were controlling the Union of Islamic Courts out of Somalia, and a lot of them ended up in here in Eritrea, where I got a good chance to know a lot of them. And so they left behind their youth wing, what was called Al-Shabaab, their youth. Right. So that's where the word Al-Shabaab comes from. It means the youth, and that's what they were. The youth wing of the Union of Islamic Courts left behind, and they took up the armed struggle against the Ethiopian invasion and occupation. And because they were basically leading a nationalist movement, the whole country united behind Al-Shabaab and the fight against the Ethiopians. And after 2 years and some 30,000 Ethiopians dead, Ethiopians were driven from most of Somalia, now, even though they did maintain bases in much and many parts of Somalia. So when the Ethiopians were driven out, the U.S. sent their next group of proxies, Plan B, Ugandans and from Burundi. And that became what's now the AFRICOM, well, not AFRICOM, but the African Union soldiers there. And technically, they're supposed to have about 17,000 troops there. But if you include the Kenyans that are there, they're well over 20,000. And they just announced at the African Union meeting in Addis Ababa that they want to add another over 6,000. They want to get close to 30,000 African Union peacekeepers, quote unquote, in Somalia. But what have these peacekeepers done? Well, when they invaded, they occupied Mogadishu and they set off a major war with Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu, which eventually flattened about 30 square miles of Mogadishu and created over a million refugees. The Ethiopian invasion created over half a million refugees. After the Ethiopians left, the African Union came in and created another half a million refugees. So there's over a million direct refugees that were created by the Western instigated and funded invasion and occupation of Somalia. Now, so then we ran into a few years back the worst drought, the Great Horn of Africa drought, the worst drought and famine in 60 years. Okay, starting about the end of 2010, going into and lasted about to the end of 2012. Now, this drought didn't only affect Somalia. It affected Somalia and southern Ethiopia, including the Ogaden, which is ethnically Somali region of Ethiopia, much of Oromia, which is actually the Oromos make up about 40 million people in Ethiopia, which is almost half or more of Ethiopia, and even in the South Sudan and northern Kenya. So we had this huge drought, okay? And the drought rolls in. Anthony Lake, formerly National Security Advisor to Bill Clinton, failed nominee to head the CIA, and who was the first and preeminent senior policy advisor on foreign affairs for Barack Obama before the Obama's election, and who was appointed by Obama to head the UNICEF, the largest children and women's relief organization in the world. Anthony Lake, okay, from CIA to UNICEF, who got up and held a press conference and announced that UNICEF, they've been for the million Somali refugees that are in refugee camps directly responsible, who the UN was directly responsible for, they had the equivalent of 10 cents a day to feed these refugees. They budgeted that much, about $35 million for a year. 10 cents a day for a million people. Now, we knew at that point that there was going to be hundreds of thousands of Somalis starved to death. And I wrote an article about it at the time saying, look, this is a conscious policy of just, you know, to wipe out the Somali people. They're going to spend over $1 billion that same year funding the African Union peacekeepers in Mogadishu, and they're only going to put $35 million defeating the million Somalis that they're funded and instigated invasion created in the first place. And lo and behold, not that long ago, the UN admitted that at least 250,000 Somalis died during that great famine. Okay, these are people that there was their watch, they were under control, and they stood back, and because of funding shortfall, let a 250,000 Somalis die. Now, that wasn't only, but the famine didn't only affect Somalia. Famine stretched throughout southern Ethiopia, and we're talking about 30 or 40 million people were affected by this famine, okay, maybe more. And we don't hear anything about what's going on in southern Ethiopia. Why? Because back in 2007, the Ethiopian regime, when they attempted to bring the Chinese oil exploration company in to exploit the natural resources of the Ogaden, southeastern Ethiopia, the Ogaden National Liberation Front fighters came in, and after warning them repeatedly, came in and attacked them and killed about a dozen Chinese and several hundred Ethiopians. And Ethiopia came in and basically set off a scorched earth genocidal policy where they kicked out all the NGOs except the most corrupt and reactionary within the UN, including Doctors Without Borders and the International Committee for the Red Cross, were expelled from the Ogaden back in 2007. And this is, there were a series of ongoing droughts at the time. So there's been a food and medical aid blockade installed by the Ethiopian regime on the Ogaden, as well as much of southern Ethiopia, which includes Oromia. Okay, so here we have the worst drought in 60 years, and you've got Doctors Without Borders and the International Committee for the Red Cross kicked out. So there's no food or medical aid being distributed in the region. The World Food Program gets up and claims that they're distributing food and medical aid, and I've got three separate World Food Program, ex-workers for the World Food Program, who told me that they witnessed grain being distributed to paramilitaries who have carried out the dirty work and the genocidal policy in the Ogaden. This aid was meant for the starving people in the Ogaden by the UN, and instead was given to the police, the infamous Rio police, the paramilitaries that were out there doing the dirty work of the Ethiopian regime. Okay, so not only isn't the aid getting there, but food aid is actually being used to make the problem worse.
To pay for their oppressors.
By supplying death squads in the region.
To exacerbate that problem of the drought and the cleansing, the World Bank and IMF were giving predatory loans to the government of Ethiopia. Do you know about any of the projects, the dams, or any of the things they've been building there, or as in a form of a predatory loan, like it's much larger than it needs to be, or not really servicing the people it's supposed to go to?
Well, you know, it's a well-kept secret that Ethiopia is the largest recipient of foreign aid in the world. I just had an article about 10 million Ethiopian refugees that have left their country or fled their country in the last decade. 10 million, a million Ethiopians a year have left the country. The article is called, you know, 10 million, Ethiopia's 10 million human tsunami. In the article, I lay out the fact that way back in 2010, the IMF head in Addis Ababa, capital of Ethiopia, let it slip, and I'm sure he paid a price for it, saying that Ethiopia's export revenue was about $1.7 billion a year, and the import bill was $8.7 billion a year. In other words, Ethiopia was depending on $7 billion in aid or loans, or whatever you want to call it, every year just to keep the government afloat. $7 billion a year, that was in 2010, and words got back to me from IMF people in Addis Ababa that now Ethiopia's aid bill is up over, I mean, Ethiopia's now got over $12 billion coming in a year, and they're only exporting about, because of the drop in coffee, their main export, about $2 billion a year. There's some $10 billion a year being pumped into Ethiopia. In other words, it's the most aid-dependent country in the world. Ethiopia receives more aid than Egypt and Israel, the next two largest recipients combined. And this is a really well-kept secret in the world. And a lot of this aid is in the form of loans. That when they speak of debt forgiveness in Africa, most of the debt forgiveness in Africa is to Ethiopia. And what does Ethiopia spend it on? Well, guess what? Ethiopia's got the largest, best-equipped army in Africa. What do they use it for? They invaded Eritrea in 2000. 123 Ethiopians died, according to Ethiopian government. In that invasion, they invaded.
So we are talking about Falkagame too, but bringing it back to Somalia and Ethiopia, you've explained the economic situation brought on by the wars, the drought, the predatory lending, and the so-called foreign aid, which ends up being used to pay police and other bullies. How has that kind of the economic conditions created from that helped feed into groups like Al-Shabaab? Because at least working for them, someone can get a paycheck, but where is that money coming from? The economic conditions created from that helped feed into groups like Al-Shabaab, because at least working for them, someone can get a paycheck, but where is that money coming from?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Something that I have my own personal belief. You know, we've heard a lot about piracy in the Horn of Africa, Somali pirates. is in the new film out, Captain Wilson. Unfortunately, what people don't tell you is that the pirates themselves have never been attacked by any Jones or, you know, they've been, once they've collected their money, no one's ever been attacked. There's been no retribution to any pirates. And they've got drones flying around, satellite photos, telling them, they know exactly where these pirates, once they collect their loot, where the pirate den is. And yet there's been no drones looking through the front door. No one, except it seems like myself, ever asked that question. Because what I've heard from high-ranking Somali sources is that the Ethiopian government, which has, most of the pirates come from Puntland, and that's, right on the tip of the Horn of Africa there. Puntland, run by a bunch of warlords and gangsters, is very close to the Ethiopian regime, previously headed by Mela Somali. And, you know, they were paying off the Ethiopian generals in the bases in Puntland, who were providing them protection, basically put them hands off to the international navies that were in the region. And that, a good chunk of that money ended up back in the bank accounts of Mela Somali, the prime minister of Ethiopia. Now, something else no one's mentioned is the fact that when Mela Somali got sick and then died, all the piracy stopped. Since Mela Somali became incapacitated and then died, all the piracy has stopped. And that's a great big coincidence. But the thing is, so the money's not coming from piracy anymore. Okay, where is it coming from? Well, people can claim that El Shabaab had the port of Kismayo, and they're exporting millions of dollars on charcoal. But see, the reality is, there's about, something like 15,000 El Shabaab fighters. And they get paid by some reports. I heard back in 2010 they were getting $200 a month apiece. Now I'm hearing they're getting about $300 a month. That's about, in other words, it's about $5 million a month, some $60 million to $70 million a year that's taking to keep El Shabaab funded. Now, where's that money coming from? Now, El Shabaab is now under the control of a Wahhabist movement. There's been an internal power struggle, and the present leadership basically wiped out the moderate leaders. Sheikh Alwais, who was really the founder of the Union of Islamic Court, 78 years old, is now in government custody. He had to flee for his life because the Wahhabists, they call him Salafist. Salafist is a code word. Wahhabi is such a bad word that it changes to Salafist now. The Salafists are the Wahhabi fanatics that run El Shabaab. Consolidated power. Now, everywhere else in the world where there's been a competent investigation of Wahhabi movements,
Saudi
found
Arabia.
That they've been funded by the Saudi royal family. Mm-hmm. Everywhere else, whenever they've looked, anybody's done a decent job of investigating, they found that the Wahhabi movement had been funded by the Saudi royal family. Many of them started 20 or 30 years ago. Many of these regions have no schools. So the Saudi royal family comes in and funds madrasas or Islamic schools that promote Wahhabism, so they get a whole generation of kids growing up as fanatics, brainwashed by this Wahhabi fanatic version of Islam. So we've got Wahhabis in Somalia now. We've got something like $70 million a year we can't account for. Now, there's people trying to claim that, there's been, people are asking that question. I mean, you can't help it. Where's the money coming from to fund this 15 or 20,000 man army? And, they think, they're extorting it from local businessmen. They're not getting $70 million a year by extorting off a local businessman. That's just not, and not only that, but the present leadership of El Shabaab wasn't actually in complete control of El Shabaab, so they weren't in a situation where they could effectively extort from that many people. So that's a good question. My personal opinion is, I think I'm very convinced that if you really went and looked, you'd find that, lo and behold, El Shabaab has actually got links to the Saudi royal family. That's where they're getting their money from.
What's their gain in financing?
$70 million a year.
I know they have the capacity to do it. What's Saudi, the royal family's gain in financing this Salafis? It's just ideological.
Well, everywhere they are, they've been their history for the last 30 or 40 years. It's part of their religious duty. They're fanatics. They're Wahhabis. They want to export their version of Islam. They consider Shia to be basically worse than Christians. It's okay to massacre Shias. Why would Saudi royal families funding suicide bombers in Iraq to blow the Shia, massacring the Shia? I mean, that's, what I'm saying? Why is the Saudi, what are they gaining by funding the Al-Qaeda in Syria? I mean, that's the whole thing. What did Saudi gain by supporting the NATO war against the Libyan people, the Al-Sir Gaddafi? I mean, it's part of the behind the scenes, the royal family thinks this is what they need. They need this true form of Islam that God has sent them to bring to the earth. I mean, I guess that's it. I mean, on the other hand, you know, it's come back to bite them in the past, but they seem to be of the opinion it seems as though, because, you know, there's like 30,000 members of the Saudi royal family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not like they're all under the control of the government. You know, they're related to high-ranking people in the government. They've got their own fortune. And, you know, what, 60 or 70 million a year is dropping a bucket to the Saudis. So, you know, what's the point? Well, you know, I mean, that's something we can debate all day long. The bottom line is, it's a Wahhabist movement, and every Wahhabi movement that's ever been investigated has been traced back to the Saudi royal family. And is that nobody's been able to come up. I mean, you know, look, 15,000, that's the minimum size of the Al-Shabaab at $300 a month, is $4.5 million a month. Okay, plus they got their food, their equipment, their weapons, which they have to buy in the black market. And so, you know, we're talking $60 or $70 million a year. Nobody's been able to explain where that money's coming from. Now, Kenya's gotten in the mix because they, at the request of the West, came in and set up a completely bogus scenario, claiming it was Al-Shabaab coming in and kidnapping people in northern Kenya, when actually all the investigation, the research has shown it was actually rogue elements in the Kenyan military or the Kenyan police or notoriously corrupt. They were kidnapping people and extorting ransom for them. Okay, but this was an excuse to get the Kenyan government, which is the same ruling family that's been there since independence, stolen every election since independence, and, you know, in their desire to please the West, that the West is pushing them. You know, the West, basically, one of the reasons I think why they had the International Criminal Court indict Kenyatta in the first place, he's now the president of Kenya, is because they wanted some leverage over him to get him to do their dirty work. The Ethiopia couldn't go back in. The Ugandans are up to their neck in fighting against, you know, they control Mogadishu and a few towns, but the rest of the countryside is under the control of Al-Shabaab in southern Somalia. So they said, Kenyan, oh, go inside and take his mile and, you know, help us get rid of Al-Shabaab. Well, Kenya jumped both feet into a quagmire. And because in northern Kenya, there's a lot of Somalis in northern Kenya. You know, Somalia was lines drawn in Africa that divided the Somalis up between Ethiopia, Somalia, and Kenya. And there's millions of Somalis in Kenya. And they started by, you know, sending a division, and now it's about a division and a half of Kenya's best army into southern Somalia. The Kenyan army is notoriously corrupt and brutal. They've been all sorts of articles about the Kenyan army instigating conflict in Kismayo, which they now occupy, and they've been extorting money out of both factions and taking their cut of the firewood trade, then rich the generals of the Kenyan army. And now Kenya, you know, and repeatedly warned if you come into Somalia, when they've been particularly brutal and murderous in southern Somalia, that there's gonna be a price to pay. And that's what happened. You know, there's blowback. You know, that's what this Westgate Mall attack was. It was about Kenya coming in and killing thousands of Somalis, you know, and carrying out counterinsurgency. Now counterinsurgency, that, you see, because the Kenya's got, the army's got these long supply lines from Kenya all the way up into Kismayo. And the supply lines not only run through Somalia, but they run through Kenya's Somali population as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are clans or families that back across borders. It's an artificial creation. You know, the Somalis are notoriously for, you killed my family and across in that valley over there, we're going to revenge you in this valley. And that's what's been going on. And Kenya's getting in deeper and deeper into trouble there. And see, on top of that, Kenya's got an independence movement in the Mombasa region on the coast, which is mainly a Muslim and was traditionally part of the Sultanate of Zanzibar. And it was forcibly incorporated into Kenya. And the people there have been extremely marginalized, and they're Muslim, and a lot of mixed between, you know, the people on the coast and Somalis and their northern neighbors. And Kenya's got a major independence movement that's going to explode just a matter of time in the Mogadishu region. And, you know, the Mogadishu is the main port in East Africa. It's got a 60,000 barrel a day oil refinery. It's got the world famous Kenyan hotel, which the land underneath of which is all owned somehow mysteriously by members of the ruling family, the Kenyatta family that's ruled Kenya since independence. So Kenya's in deep in trouble now. So, I mean, I had an article called Kenya's in Trouble, Serious Trouble, you know, early last year, basically predicting all of this. So, you know, I'm saying is that the whole region is unstable. You don't even want to get me started about how the U.S. basically separated Sudan. I've got I'm the only one that's been able to come up with a real history of how the United States forced the Sudanese to accept the peace deal and have this referendum, which the founding father of South Sudanese independence, John Garang, was vehemently opposed to. So in any case, that's another story. But, you know, the destabilization of the region, basically all this fighting that's going on is basically a Western main United States creation, part of crisis management.
I wonder if South Sudan could get a pipeline through to Kenya to the ports, since, you know, the North Sudan is cutting it off.
Well, there's a lot of crazy things. Uganda, just the Chinese just announced that they're going to be building a pipeline from or a railway or something. They're going to be exploiting Ugandan oil. They talk about an oil pipeline from South Sudan, but South Sudan only has about 800 million barrels of oil. Most of the oil in that geological deposit there is actually in the Gambela region in western Ethiopia, which is at the bottom of the geological accumulation, the reservoir. There's about a billion barrels there. But, you know, to build a pipeline for 800 million barrels is almost probably not going to happen. You know, I mean, China's done a lot of crazy things.
That's what
they're talking about,
China
building a railway from Addis Ababa to Djibouti. $3 billion railway from Addis Ababa to Djibouti, which, if you look at the map, one side of the railway is occupied by the Afar people, which are in an insurgency against the Ethiopian government, and the other side is occupied by the Somalis in the Ogaden region, which are in an insurgency against the Ethiopian government. And you're going to build a railway which is notoriously vulnerable to small-scale attacks right down the middle of it. So, I mean, there's a lot of crazy things going on in terms of foreign investment and plans and what they're going to do. And a lot of it's just ill-advised, and some of it's just downright diabolical.
I was wondering, when we were talking about the ideological reasons why Saudi Arabia is financing al-Shabaab, we don't know that, but if there might be economic motivation too. I mean, they have their tensions with the South Yemen movement on the other side of the strait with Aden, and then they'd like to have Somalia as well. And as when you're asking about Syria, they did have the agreement for the line going from Iran through Iraq to Syria, which would have been an all-Shiite territory line too, and break the Azerbaijan-Turkey pipeline monopoly too. But it's hard to, I guess, unravel what the motivations are, whether it's ideological or economic or both. But I do see some possible economic incentives for the royals as well.
Well, you know, Al-Qaeda in Yemen is mostly Saudis. The Saudi government finally got cracked down on Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden had to leave. He went to Sudan, and first thing he tried to do was set up an Islamic regime in Eritrea, which is newly independent and half Muslim. So we've got Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which is mostly Saudi, and still being funded by Saudis. Okay? So, and nobody's even talking about that anymore. They're just talking about Al-Qaeda in Yemen. They're not talking about the Saudi connection. Half of Yemen is Shia, and all the Saudi oil is in the Shia part of Saudi, which is in eastern Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the Shia minority are there and oppressed and rather brutally. And so, you know, Saudis, they've got a lot of potential explosive issues of their own. But, you know, I don't think it's, you know, again, like I'd like to say, we don't know for sure. But, you know, just like the Ansar al-Adin in Mali, all of a sudden came out of nowhere and became the predominant force in Mali, after, you know, over just swept through. Heavily armed and heavily funded, where did all that money come from? I mean, you know, maybe some people try to say it was from the cocaine trade, but no, that doesn't fly. When you take a look at the real statistics that are verifiable, no, there's not that much cocaine coming to Europe from North Africa. And the fact is that they were Wahhabi, they call them Salafis, and that they came out of nowhere because all of a sudden they got an influx of money. From where? Well, we know that Saudi's been heavily involved in Mali and their madrasa system for many, many decades now. So again, we know that there are Saudi-funded madrasas in Somalia for decades now, okay? Since the collapse of the regime 20 years ago, the Saudis have been the main supporters of these fanatical madrasas or religious schools in Somalia. So we already know Somalia's got a link to the Saudi royal family through the Saudi royal family's funding of these religious schools. And the next step is, the kids that grow up in these religious schools get up brainwashed as Wahhabis, and you know, they go back to their benefactors and say, look, we want to establish this Wahhabi country here, and they say, yeah, that's a great school, let's do it. We need more Wahhabism in the world. I mean, so, you know, again, every time there's been a competent investigation into Wahhabi movement, it's come back to Saudi. So, I mean, if after all of these experiences, it's, you know, at a certain point where you just have to assume that that's the case, because it's been the case every other time before.
And that is a very popular method of financing it through religious schools. Some of the so-called, whatever you want to say, moderate schools in Turkey were funded by through NATO agents as well. So we see
in
that
Pakistan,
sort of,
and Afghanistan.
Afghanistan,
you
look,
you see these fanatic, they were Saudi-funded religious schools that were the basis of it. And sometimes it took 20 or 30 years to come to fruit, but that's always been the case.
Well, I wish somebody could get a good investigation into it. It seems like the first question you're supposed to ask is who's benefiting and how are they paying for it?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. And the other thing, but the big crime that happened is that this massive famine, there was a, you know, 250,000 died in Somalia in a couple of years and another 250,000 died in Ethiopia, where there was a food and medical aid blockade. We're talking about 500,000 people. At one point, up to 1,000 people were starving to death every day in the region, and nobody in the world ever heard a thing about it. I mean, we had a Dirty Wars movie about the drones and all these sensational stories about what was really going on in the Horn of Africa, America's Dirty Wars, and the author of the book and the movie actually was in Mogadishu in the summer of 2011 as the drought was killing some 500 or 600 people every day. The two-day blockade was, and the drought, and the UN was starving people to death deliberately, and not a mention of any of this. 500,000 people starved to death, and you make a movie about the region and don't even mention this? I mean, this is some expose, sensational expose. I mean, just the fact that the guy was allowed in the Mogadishu in the first place must have tipped you off, because you got to be vetted by the CIA to be let in there if you're a journalist. And the guy was driving around with armed bodyguards. Who vetted all that? And what did he write about? He didn't write about the famine and the hundreds of people starving to death every day, maybe 1,000 people dying every day in the region. Not a mention of all that. I mean, I've been, you know, in fact,
that's Jeremy
Scahill,
I think you're talking about.
But I can't keep quiet anymore.
Sure.
It's never hurt anybody. Wait a minute. 500,000 people starving to death, and that's a conservative figure. And not a mention when you write a book about the region?
Well,
that's a real crime. That's a major crime. That's a human, huge, enormous crime against humanity. When the UN budgets 10 cents a day to feed people, you can't feed people on 10 cents a day. You know people are 100,000, 200, a quarter million people are going to die from starvation if you only give them 10 cents a day to live on.
Now they give foreign aid to Al-Qaeda.
Medical aid blockade.
The U.S. will give foreign aid to
all these
deaths.
What country in the world is allowed to expel the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders in the middle of the worst drought and famine in 60 years? Only Ethiopia. Allowed to kick the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders. How come there aren't sanctions against Ethiopia? No. Instead, they're giving Ethiopia $10 billion a year. They're rewarding them for these crimes.
Why isn't there more press about it, do you think?
Hey, you know, the New York Times reporter that was based in Nairobi in 2012 won the P. Pulitzer Prize for the fact that he didn't ever write about any of this. This is a conscious plot to basically keep all of this quiet. The Western media doesn't want to talk about this major crime. And this is like one of the best-kept secrets in the world. You know, I mean, how is it that Ethiopia can survive on $2 billion a year when it imports, when there's 80 million, over 80 million people in the country? And they're only exporting $2 billion a year? How come nobody's talking about this? How can Ethiopia get away with kicking out, you know, the Doctors Without Borders and the Red Cross in the middle of a drought when everybody's talking about, oh, there's a drought, there's a drought. There's no secret there's a drought. But how come they didn't talk about the fact that Ethiopia is preventing food and medical aid to some 8 or 10 million Somalis in Ogaden? Not, let alone in the Romia as well, where there's a low-grade insurgency going on there as well. So, I mean, it's like, you know, to me, it's almost like a smokescreen. Somebody comes and writes a sensational book and diverts everybody away. It's sort of like when there was the alleged Darfur genocide going on. You know, I've interviewed over a dozen veteran aid agency workers that spent together over 50 years in Darfur, going back to 2004 when the real killings were going on, and not one of them agrees that there was a genocide there. They say maybe 20 to 30,000 people died. And if somebody in the UN, nobody will identify who, said 200 or 300,000 died. But wait a second. At the same time the Darfur fighting was going on, mainly in 2004, was almost finished by 2005. And the whole Save Darfur thing was launched about 2006, 2007, 2008. $100 million raised for Save Darfur, and I can't find any evidence any of it ever made it to Darfur. And they're all pro-Israel groups that raised the money. And at the same time, there's a food and medical aid blockade going on in Ogaden. from 2007, while everybody's saying, save Doppler. George DeLooney Clooney's up there saying, oh, we got to save Doppler. We got to, you know, Angelina Jolie and Cody press conferences and saying that the United States has got to declare war and maybe bomb Sudan in 2009. All the while, her buddy Nella Somali, who helped her adopt an Ethiopian baby, has got a food medical aid blockade in the Ogaden. The real genocide is in the Ogaden, southern Ethiopia. Instead, they create a smokescreen saying it's in Darfur. Well, maybe 20,000, 30,000 people died, and that was years beforehand. Okay, so, you know, I'm saying is that there's always some kind of a smokescreen they've got to put up to cover the real crimes. When you start seeing people talking, the Western media start talking about, when you start seeing CNN promoting a film called Dirty War, CNN, these notorious liars, and you know, the ones that helped create the whole weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and blamed Gaddafi for killing 10,000 of his own people, and Amnesty International said that until the Western intervention, there's only been 110 people killed in Benghazi, and that included Gaddafi supporters. 110 people killed, that was a pretext for to come in and protect the people. So in any case, you know, there's always a smoke screen being created. And you always got to divert you from the real crimes that are going on. And that's why, you know, don't believe anything you read when it comes to the Horn of Africa, and very little of what you see is what I advise everybody.
It's always some humanitarian pretext or a scare tactic. And then it turns out later not to be true, and oh, too late, millions are dead. But that's why I'm having you on. I'm trying to build new media. That's why I'm doing this. So.
Yeah. That's why we need guys like you. You know, if your listeners out there, you've got Ryan Dawson is doing the good work, man. There's not very many people like you. And I've always tell people that interview me that, you know, I always put a plug on the show and say, look, guys out there, you got to support people like Ryan because, you know, without it, how are you going to hear the truth? I mean, I've been living in the retreat since 2006. And I don't even like being a journalist, but I've been forced to be a journalist because no one else, I'm a historian, a cultural historian, and an educator. I mean, I'm living out here, and my goal is really to do something in the environmental movement that's, you know, to try to help us prepare for the apocalypse that they're talking about in terms of global warming. You know, I mean, I can't just sit back and say 500,000 people starved to death in, you know, the last few years, and nobody outside even knows this. Or if they do, they think, oh, Africans are starving again. No, it's not Africans are starving. 1 million refugees in Somalia are created by the U.S.-backed invasion.
They aren't dismissive like that, though.
They only budgeted 10 cents a day to do so.
They don't understand about the wars and the predatory lending and how foreign aid doesn't ever really reach the poor, usually. All that's missing, just like, oh, Africa is just, they just starve. They just don't know how to grow food or something. They're very dismissive about it, or, oh, the Middle East, they're just crazy, right?
You know? It's always about Africans killing Africans, you know? Mm-hmm. Every time it's about Africans killing Africans, but then you really dig, almost always the case that it's not about Africans killing Africans. It's about Africans being funded by the West, doing dirty work on behalf of the West.
Mm-hmm. Same model.
But, you know, again,
Central
coming
America.
Back to the Horn of Africa, people don't understand just how strategically critical Horn of Africa has become. The biggest trading partners in the world, all of these cars, all of this manufactured goods, and the world's factory, China, going to Europe, going to, you know, even up through into North America, is coming up through the Horn of Africa.
Passes
every day, there's some 350 container ships passing through the Horn of Africa every day.
Plus Pepe Escobar and I are getting ready to talk about trade routes. So right after this, I'll be talking with Pepe, and we're going to touch into some of the 7 choking points and things like that. But, I'm down to 93 cents, so I got to let you go, but I will have you on in the near future, and I really appreciate, even though you are a historian and environmental worker, being a journalist anyway, because we need these voices out there. We need more people to...
Yeah, and like I said, you listen, support Ryan's work, man. People got to come up with the money. I know times are hard, but people got to support you, because Ryan's doing that for love, and if people, you know, you can't live on love. But out there, if you're listening, you guys got to make a contribution to Ryan's program.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Yes, and the more you contribute, the more I can call these exotic places and get these great guests, everybody. Thanks, Thomas. Yeah, you're great.
Okay, take care, Charles.
Thank you. Bye-bye.